session number 27341,
Reel 1. Maybank, Reel 1. John, could you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in England, in Thornton Heath, Surrey, in 1922. My father was a New Zealand soldier. He'd fought at Gallipoli and been wounded and was knocked about. And he recuperated at Malta General Hospital. And from there, he was sent to Aldershot to recover and to take some physical training. He did so well at that he was made an instructor, which saved his life probably, because he never had to go to war again. So he got married post-war. I was born, and he went back to New Zealand and became a member of the New Zealand Defence Force. Now, the Defence Force was had about a total of 500 men. All of them were either officers or NCOs, and they were the only military in New Zealand and were responsible for the territorial training, the army, the school cadet forces, and training and shooting, camping, horse riding, you name it, because we had mounted rifles and things like that, which were rather like the British cavalry, only a bit rougher. And I went to England with my mother in 1925, grew up in New Zealand, went to school in New Zealand, and when the war started, my father had left the army and started his own business as a baker. He bought a business. I don't know where he got the money to do that, but anyway, he bought a business because the Depression had been on. It was a pretty grim time in New Zealand, as it was everywhere. And he started this business, and it grew and grew, and he got a lot of government contracts because of the war. The Army and the Air Force gave him contracts. He made a lot of money. Anyway, I joined the Fleet Air Arm in July 1940, when I was 18.
Before we do that, could I ask you a little bit about your education?
Yes, I went to a school called Marlborough College in Blenheim. I did all my secondary school education there. And I left in 1938 before I'd matriculated, because I had an opportunity to become an electrical engineer. My father didn't push me to join his business, and I didn't want to, because I'd seen what baking meant, which is a hideous job. I started with the Marlborough Electric Power Board as a trainee, and I had a 2-year or 2.5-year stint of every 6 months I'd change and do something different. I went out with the linesmen and dug holes for posts and spliced wires and things like that, and soldered wires and things. And it was an open air life. And I mean, really, you had to dig a post hole. I used to use these compressed pine trees poles, and you dug a hole, whatever feet it was deep, a spade's width and a half. And it couldn't be any more than that, because they didn't want to have to put rocks down. And anyway, that's what I did for 6 months. And then I did another stint cleaning old gas cookers and electric cookers and things like that, because they sold them, and they'd buy second-hand stuff and sell it. And then I did a spell with the inspector, because in New Zealand everything was controlled. All electrical equipment had to be handled by an electrician, a qualified wireman, they called them, licensed. And whether it was a protection for the union, or whether it was safety, probably a mix of both. But anyway, if the householder started to mess around with his electrics, they'd cut the power off. And if he had a faulty piece of equipment, they had to take it in to a proper electrical shop and have it repaired and a certificate issued to say it had been repaired. So that was the sort of life one led in those days. So I went into practically every house in my hometown, a place called Blenheim in New Zealand, and in the South Island, and did that for 6 or 8 months. And I was just getting going on the hydroelectric, because we had our own hydroelectric power supply up at the top of the Wairau River. And I was just starting on that when I was called up in the army. Now, everybody had to do military service. And so, you know, everybody of an age. And I was sent off to camp. But they knew that I'd joined the Fleet Air Arm, and I was also at that stage a territorial, which was, the sort of training, territorial army.
Yeah, what kind of training had you done with the territorial army?
What training did
I do with them?
Well, I was a very good shot, 303. I had shot for the school against all the other schools of the British Empire, and we came third, I think. In the King George V Cup. When you say, what did I do? Very little, really. We marched, and we had a band. We had horses. We had bandoliers. We wore bandoliers and slouch hats. Well, they weren't really. They were the New Zealand spiked hat, like a Boy Scout hat. But that was it was never good days. And we dug trenches in the park to stop the Japs. But it was all great fun. But, it was a sort of, I suppose those days were desperate because we didn't know what was happening. This was before the Japanese came in, of course. I think about 1941 I went into the army, and then I was actually taken away from Blenheim and had to go to Burnham, which is in the south near Christchurch, and we did some more training, more serious training, but the unit was the same unit. It was the same Marlborough unit that started off, and we went down there and marched around. We were in this military camp where most of the training done for the overseas people was carried out, and I suppose one by one our team of people, our unit, would have gone off as replacements to Egypt or wherever it was that they were needed, and mostly in Egypt in those days, because the Desert War was still going.
You'd volunteered for the Fleet Air Arm, you said, in 1940.
Yes, but I wasn't called up until 1942. The reason for that was there were so many New Zealanders going into the Fleet Air Arm that there was a bottleneck, and they were only taking 20 a month. That was a sort of round figure. I think there were 21 of us that went over there. And I was called up and went to HMS NZS Tamaki in Auckland in August 1942.
Is there a reason why so many New Zealanders joined the Fleet Air Arm?
No one ever told us, but I think it was an arrangement made with the Navy. The Royal Navy had their own unit in New Zealand. The Commodore was, I think, an Englishman. All the instructors were English. The petty officers, naval officers, such as there were only very few, were English. And I think that they'd come to some arrangement with the government that they would take New Zealanders. And it was pretty structured. And there were so many New Zealanders. We all joined the RNZAF to start with. We had to. That was a requirement because we had to join some outfit that was there. And we had a medical, which was arranged through the RNZAF. Now, I hadn't matriculated, so they made me matriculate. They said, right, well, you better go back to school. And they had courses for people who were like me, they thought was probably could make reasonable material. So I matriculated, and it took about 6 months or so. And that also was part of the holdup.
Was there a problem, obviously, because you've been called up with the Territorials and the Army?
Yeah. Now, the Army were perfectly okay because they knew that I had been accepted by the Navy as a pilot or air crew, whatever it might have been. And so there was no problem with the Army at all. So as soon as... And I'd already passed my RAF or RNZAF medical... And so the whole question of whether I went into the Army or the Navy, it was all settled long before. And so I just went, and I had a little certificate saying what my service had been, and I gave that to the Navy. And that was recorded in my naval records that I had previous Army service of 1 year and 6 months or whatever it was. I can't remember.
So this initial training... Hmm. What did that involve?
Which initial training?
The one when you went to Tamaki.
Tamaki?
Yeah.
Well, we were there some weeks, and I can't remember how many, probably about 5 or 6 weeks, during which time we had a lot of injections. And what we did was mainly drill and rowing. The idea of the rowing was they had these long boats, or they were heavy boats, rowing boats, and we had to row around Tamaki after we'd had injections. They said to get it circulating through the blood. Oh, God. Anyway, we were all crippled with these injections, but we had to row. And I suppose it was a good idea because it certainly got it through the system quite quickly. It exhausted us anyway. It was pulling these huge oars and the big boats of 40 men or something would hold. It was just incredible.
So is that difficult to get the coordination when you're first rowing with that many men?
Yes, well, it weren't that many. It was 20 of us, I suppose, and we had to row. And I can't remember now what the size of the boat was, but it seemed huge. And the oars were heavy, and our arms were sore, you know. And other than that, we marched around, and every time in the Navy you run, you don't march anywhere except as a military routine. When you're marching, you're marching. But otherwise, when you're moving from one place to another, you ran, you know, and double time, and off you ran all around this camp, and then they gave us a bit of leave. Well, I was too far away. Blenheim, my hometown's in the north of the South Island. And it was a long journey. So I just, they gave us a week off. So I went and had a look at the North Island near Auckland. And I can't remember whether we hired a car. I think we hired a car, certainly. And poodled about. Petrol wasn't too bad in New Zealand in those days. So there were no restrictions.
What had your accommodation been like?
What, in the Navy? Hammocks.
Right from the start?
Right from the start. Which we slung in a long barracks block, which had beams down and hooks, and you slung a hammock. And that's how we slept.
And most people don't sleep in hammocks. Is there a technique for getting into a hammock?
Yes, there is. There is indeed. You sort of hurled yourself at it. It's a bit of a knack. It's hard to describe, actually, but you finally have to get a balance. You have to be balanced, because otherwise you'll fall out. But once you're in it properly, the hammock goes quite deeply down, and so its sides, when you're in it, are quite high. And so you can't easily look over the top. Yeah. And it was very snug. They're a nice place to... And you had blankets, of course. Didn't have any mattress, but you had blankets, but it was comfortable. Because you were held up there by these ropes. And nobody had any problem sleeping in hammocks. But I don't think we ever had... We slept in hammocks. No, we didn't sleep in hammocks on the ship. But I don't recall that we ever slept in hammocks again, but we had to carry these flaming hammocks around with us everywhere we went.
And what about food and messing facilities?
The food was good. Yes, the food, well, in New Zealand, the food would be good, you know. And we had to go to the dining room, or what? It was another barracks block where they had the tables and trestles and things. It's all fairly vague memories of the food, but no one ever worried about it, so I can only imagine it was quite nice food.
Was this period then really familiarisation with the Navy?
Was very, very tough, because they were all English petty officers, and they knew they had to get us into shape. Now, we were all young lads. I mean, I was just 20, but others there were younger. There were a couple of two or three older, but not much. So we were very fit, and we'd all been in the army. Nearly everybody there had been in the army. In fact, I don't think there was anybody who wasn't in the army. And, of course, the army regime in New Zealand was, again, that was quite tough, rigorous. And you're always running and marching. We used to do 20-mile marches, so we were pretty strong lads, and very fit. But by golly, the Navy made us fitter. Those few weeks that we were at Tamaki, running all the time, sometimes with rifles held above your head, we were extraordinarily fit.
How did you get on with the instructors?
Very well. They were nice men, really. They were hard, tough, but there was never any brutality, never. It was all firm discipline, it was a nice. It was really quite a pleasant few weeks, except that they were giving us these injections all the time. And I don't know how many we had, but it seemed to go on endlessly. And every time we had to go and row this bastard boat.
Did you get any instruction in sort of basic seamanship then at all?
Not a lot. I think there was some. It wasn't until we got to England that we had, if you like, seamanship training at HMS St Vincent.
After your leave had finished then, did you embark?
We embarked on a ship called the Dominion Monarch after our leave, and unescorted came out over to England via the Panama Canal. And it was in 1942 that all those German submarines were sinking vessels around the American coast. Fortunately, we were well out to sea, but we were fired at. There was torpedoes said to have gone past our stern during the voyage. But the only incident that I can recall vividly was that I was on lookout. They made us do lookout duties. I was on lookout in the bow, and I spotted a mast. Now, we had a telephone there, and I rang up the bridge and I said, there's a thing sticking out of the water, out of the sea, and I gave the directions. It was about, you know, five degrees port side, straight ahead virtually. So the ship just moved straight away and went at it. And it turned out to be a lifeboat, riddled with holes, machine gun holes, obviously, which was almost submerged, but still floating, because it was wood, and the wood hadn't sort of got too waterlogged yet. Not sufficient for it to sink anyway. It probably may never have sunk, I don't know, but anyway, we went past it, and it was a pretty ghastly sight to see all these wooden, all these holes and in the sides. And you wondered if anybody had been in it when they'd fired at it. But, and then we came on home to, we landed at Liverpool. And I think it was around about early November of that order, and we went to Leon Solent.
Can you tell me how, really step by step, what happened as you arrived at Leon Solent? How were you met?
Well, we were taken, we were interviewed when we got to Leon Solent. I don't recall just exactly what happened, frankly, because it was all sort of novel and new, but routine interview, talk to, this is what you're going to do. We weren't given any particular equipment yet. It was really a waiting, have some leave time. We did a bit of gardening. I remember I was gardening in Rafe Richard and Richardson and Laurence Olivier, both a couple of lieutenants in the fleet around, sauntered past and sort of watched us as we did. I thought, you cheeky buggers. Anyway, here we were, all this bunch of New Zealanders wheeling around the barracks box. And this is fleet Arab stuff. Good training. Anyway, we then, after about 3 weeks, I think, we went to St. Vincent, where we were immediately issued with flying kit. And,
what did that consist of, your first sort of flying kit that you were given?
I'm not sure, actually, that I'm correct here, but I think I'm right. Well, there were flying boots. I mean, it may have been at the end of the course. I can't remember the route, it may have been because I think pretty well everybody passed their exams, and whether we got the flying kit at the beginning or the end, I can't recall, and it doesn't really much matter. But we did a lot of marching at St. Vincent, but we also did a whole lot of training courses. Seamanship was one of the most important, tying knots. There were various things that they were insisted upon, that you were first a sailor and then secondly you were an airman. So if you follow the drift, they weren't too interested in the air, but they were very interested, because they were all sailors there, in our becoming sailors first, that we were Navy, don't forget it.
So what degree of seamanship did you have to learn? What were the types of things that you were learning?
Oh, well, they taught us navigation, sea navigation, air navigation. They taught us meteorology. They taught us ship identification, aircraft identification, engineering, air engineering. That was something I could never really get to grips with, because I always thought, well, if I'm going to be flying an aeroplane and the engine stops, there's one thing certain, I'm not going to get out and repair it. So I never really cottoned on to engineering. It seemed to me to be a first-class waste of time. We did a bit of shooting. We did a lot of marching around, square bashing. We did a lot of scrubbing of Chief Petty Officer Wilmot's office floor. He used to pick on me. I don't know why. I was probably a cheeky sod. But I certainly scrubbed his floor a few times. And I always thought he was a cruel man, but actually he wasn't at all. He was a very nice chap. But I don't think there was anything, you know, other than those. There were probably about 6 or 8 subjects that we had to look to pass. And seamanship was very important to the Navy, so we really, and we had a seamanship manual which we were expected to learn and understand. And it was a fine book. It really was. It was excellent. I've lost my copy of it. I'm sorry about that, because I had it for years, but it disappeared somewhere in the moves of one's life.
Did it cover all aspects of seamanship that you need to?
Well, it was. No, it did, but if you like, essential seamanship rather than the more sophisticated elements of moving ships around the place. I mean, we didn't get into that area much. We were taken on board a little old First World War destroyer and taken for a trip round the Isle of Wight, just to sort of indoctrinate us to what sea, being at sea, was like. It was bloody cold, and that was quite a thrill, really. But it lasted for about 4 hours, and then we were back on dry land again at Gosport.
One of the things that you did actually mention was aircraft and ship recognition.
Yes.
How did they instruct you in that, and how important?
There were a lot of photographs, but silhouettes was the big thing, both profile and elevation. Drawings and profile rather than plan, and the you simply just learnt them by rote. In fact, what one was doing all the time was sort of drawing them, because that seemed to be a good way of learning how to recognise them. We got pretty good at it, and the exam was really quite good, because they just flash it up, and then you wrote down what you thought it was, you see, and they had them coming at you too, you know, straight on. And, well, it was, and ship recognition was another thing too, because you had to be able to recognise a ship. Also, you had to be able to judge its speed. So you would be given a photograph of, say, a German Prince Eugen or one of the battle wagons going along with a big bow wave, and you had to say one that was doing 30 knots, you see, or whatever you thought it was. And you had to say what ship it was. And we got to know these ships, because every ship or class of ship had a slightly different profile, and it was surprising how eventually it sunk in that you were looking. The ones that always fooled me were the Japanese ships, because they were just so, they had so much gadgetry, and their profiles were so different. They were different from the British and German. They seemed to have a hell of a lot of guns, top hamper of one kind or another, and it was just very, very difficult to remember what it was. I mean, you could tell a battleship, so you had to guess a bit. But we seemed to pass, so that was the main thing.
Another thing you mentioned was navigation.
Yes.
So what kind of level were you learning navigation at that point?
Well, we had to learn the principles of navigation, air navigation, and I suppose, really, I never had to learn it again. I mean, it was what I did there was adequate enough to take me all the way through, right through flying school as well, because it was all quite straightforward stuff. I mean, you know, I can't remember the detail now, but there was nothing complicated about it. We had to learn logarithms, but, you know, you had your little book of logarithms there, and you used that quite a lot. But because after a while, you got used to using your compass, and we had radio aids too, you know, to get from where we were back home to the ship. We needed those, I can tell you.
But the basic principles were there,
saw me all the way through, really, because once you know that, I mean, any additional requirement was it was just a variation, that's all. It wasn't as though you had to learn. We didn't have to do astral navigation, although I'd bought a book on it, and that really was very confusing because I still don't know one star from another, except the Southern Cross.